Now come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out door.
Come over here, kid. Why so? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see? You start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Hope you've had a good weekend. So much stuff going on. The benefit for the book festival with John Ash, the Gravenstein Apple Fair where I spent the day, beautiful days for farmers markets. It's just a great time in Northern California. Not too hot. We like that. Long-time Mouthful listeners will recognize that tonight's topic is one of my favorite topics. If you're new to Mouthful, you're going to have a great time. We are talking about absinthe. I think it was 10 years ago that Mouthful did its first absinthe show, and that was actually the first time I ever tasted or even really saw absinthe. We had Barnaby Conrad III on. He, of course, wrote Absinthe, History in a Bottle, and he brought some. And I thought, oh my goodness, the forbidden elixir, I can't believe I have it. And lo and behold, as the 20th century ended and we got into the 21st century, there was this new enthusiasm about absinthe. And quietly last December, the ban on absinthe in the United States was lifted. There was a little bit of a frenzy of purchasing the brand new absinthe from Hangar One and a couple of imports from Traverso's in December and early January. And there's been, I think, increased interest in the remarkable collection of original absinthe posters that you can see for not very much longer at the Wine Exchange in Sonoma. And so we have one guest by phone this evening and one guest here in the studio. We have John Troia, I said that right, of Tempest Fugit Spirits.
That's correct, Tempest Fugit.
He has brought the most amazing collection of absinthe glasses and absinthe spoons. But we also have joining us by phone, because he is still at work at the Wine Exchange, Dan Noreen. Dan, are you there?
Yes.
Ah, the miracle of modern technology. Don't you love it? So, Dan, I discovered your collection of absinthe posters pretty much entirely by accident. I also discovered last week by accident that it's going to be leaving.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how that collection came about and what it encompasses?
Well, as a longtime student of wine and spirits, I became fascinated with absinthe before I was even old enough to drink. And all the artists and poets and musicians that imbibed, 100 years ago in Paris and the rest of France, just really intrigued me. So in the back of my mind, I thought, well, if I ever make any money in this business, I'd like to do an absinthe poster collection and collect the original posters. So I was fortunate enough to have a good friend who's a chef in San Francisco, Drew Jerky, and Drew is also a vintage poster dealer on the side, and he helped us build this collection. So we were really lucky, because we got in just before absinthe really started to get intriguing for way too many people and way too many collectors.
Yeah. When did the posters, how far back do they go?
The oldest one we have is from 1892, and the most recent is about 1904.
And how many are in the collection?
There's about 30 right now.
Uh-huh. And when I was over there talking to you, I was getting ready to write that article that ran in Saver Magazine mm-hmm. in, I think, 2003. One of the things I thought was interesting that you explained was how so many of the posters have a keyhole or some other means by which the viewer is looking into another dimension. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, because I think what people don't really realize about absinthe and what really hasn't been featured too much in any of the literature, though if you look at some esoteric texts, absinthe really is a rudimentary alchemical product. And by that I mean that there are herbs in there that have psychoactive properties and narcotic properties, and way back when absinthe was first invented, over 200 years ago, the herbologists understood this, and they knew how to mix the herbs to get the most soothing, most interesting drink possible, and the most healing drink possible, because it certainly didn't start out as a drink for the masses. It started out as a drink to make people feel better.
And that it does.
Yes, and that it does.
I can testify to that.
Yeah.
Also, tell me a little bit about the colors. There seems to be, when there's a lot of that really pale, beautiful green, almost the same green that you see in the northern lights.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it seems that when you drink absinthe, there's a little bit of intensification of certain colors.
Certainly, especially green and red, yeah. Yeah, and also intensification of halos around lights. And, of course, sound and smell as well. And then, of course, it also intensifies motion. So all these properties, when the drink is not being abused and when you have a really good absinthe, can be just, you know, a wonderful, relaxing experience.
How much longer are the posters going to be on view there at the Wine Exchange? And I should say the Wine Exchange on the square, East First Street in downtown Sonoma.
Well, I did keep two really little small ones, but the rest will be going to John and his partner Peter, and we're hoping they're going to have them up in their office in Marin County sometime soon.
Okay, so for the next few days, people can stop by?
Oh, sure.
Okay, great.
I think so.
Well, I know that you're still open over there in Sonoma, so I'm not going to keep you on the phone for too long, but I should say that you are a source. You won't be able to see the whole collection, but you do have some of the absinthe glasses and spoons.
Yeah, John is bringing some wonderful stuff into California that we're featuring. The glasses are just marvelous. In fact, right now I just poured myself a splash of the St. George Absinthe Verit from Hangar 1 and put it into John's double bubble glass, which makes an incredible louche that looks just like the clouds in the background for the absinthe robette that Privé Le Bon did.
Well, we will be raising a glass with you very, very soon. Dan, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks a lot, Anna. Best to John.
See
you soon.
Thank
you, Dan.
Okay, take care, you guys.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, I guess we should raise a glass at the same time Dan is raising a glass. So why don't you, John, talk about the ritual and let's get it going here.
Oh, sure.
And which would you recommend someone try first?
Well, there are a couple of products that we're bringing in that we felt the time was right, and they were essentially perfected to the level where we felt they represented the very best of their category. And we're not the first products on the market, clearly, but we'd like to think that they're some of the better products on the market. I like to start people off with actually a tasting of some of our competitors' products, the Lucid being the first absinthe that was commercially legalized in the U.S. recently, is one that that I think people are most familiar with. And then I have them move on to the St. George product because it's such an interesting product, and it is a local or a U.S.-made product. And then I move them into one of our other products that we import. There are two products that we have coming from Switzerland and one product currently coming from France. The Swiss products are the Duplay and the Marilyn Manson Absinthe, Mansinthe. And the French product is the Vieux Pontarlier coming from Pontarlier, France, from the Pernod Distillery. And at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition that was held in the spring, the Vieux Pontarlier won double gold best of class, and the Mansinthe actually won the gold, which I was quite pleased with because it is a very good quality absinthe. And I think there's a lot of circumstances where people believe that a celebrity endorsement is simply just that, just a celebrity endorsement. Whereas with the Mansinthe, Marilyn Manson was quite integral in the development of that particular product, and he has quite a refined palate, in fact, quite a finicky palate. He's had a chance to essentially taste some of the best. And so when he determined that something met his standards, then we knew that it was going to be a high-quality product. So
now, I did not know that Marilyn Manson and absinthe. I just had no idea. And the Lucid, now that is that very familiar cat-like bottle, black bottle with golden cat's eyes on it.
That's correct.
Okay, so I guess we start with that now. In a lot of the pictures and in a lot of the things that one reads about absinthe is you have the sugar cube. Do you do that? Do you recommend that?
Well, yeah, I think that's always a good way for people to start. Now, it really depends on how refined your palate is.
Mm-hmm.
I have a tendency to try absinthe straight only from the standpoint that I'm typically in and around the distillation process, and you taste the distillate quite frequently while it's being distilled to kind of get a sense of how it's coming out, the mm-hmm. kind of herbal notes that are arriving, and so you almost get used to drinking it straight, but I don't consume a whole serving straight. It's just a little taste here and a mm-hmm. little taste there. If I really want to assess its qualities, I want to add water to it, because by adding water, I'm going to start the drink's going to bloom. The essential mm-hmm. oils are going to start
it's
coming
like that
in.
Sort of blossoming that you get with single malt scotch.
Exactly,
as well.
Exactly. And it's always good to see how it changes when you start adding a sweet note. Now, I first started off drinking absinthe with a full sugar cube. But over time, I have scaled back to maybe half a sugar cube, or I'll actually use a pure cane syrup that is in liquid form, and I'll add a dash of that to the absinthe if I'm not going through the whole ritual of the spoon and the sugar cube.
Mm-hmm.
But there are times when it's pretty zen to serve yourself up an absinthe and to have the spoon there and the sugar cube and to slowly pour the water over it. It's just kind of a very relaxing environment that you create for yourself, and certainly a fun and interesting environment for guests if you have guests over and you're serving absinthe.
Yeah, we don't really have enough rituals.
No.
And this is one of the very nice rituals that is now legal.
Yes.
We should probably say for people who are new to absinthe mm-hmm. that it is, what is the current range of alcohol? It's a liqueur.
It's
a licorice flavored liqueur.
Yeah, well, it's
or anise flavored.
Yeah, yeah, and I think a lot of people, you know, it's that licorice note and it's that anethol that comes from the Florence fennel and the green anise
mm-hmm.
that gives you that licorice flavor. Star anise, which some of the producers use, which actually isn't necessarily related to, like, green anise, but it has a very high amount of anethol in it that gives you that licorice taste.
What about true licorice root? Is that ever used?
Occasionally that's used. It is something that when you distill it, depending on how you distill it, it doesn't quite have the oomph that people would think. And it might, if I was to use licorice, it would be to add a slight sweet note to the absinthe.
Yeah,
itself.
I mean, if you make licorice root tea, it's very sweet.
Yeah,
without
exactly.
Adding anything, it's
exactly.
very, very sweet.
And pastis, for example, uses star anise,
mm-hmm.
and the more anethol you have, the more cloudy the louche is going to be, and the more quickly the louche develops. And for those people that are just getting oriented with absinthe, the louche is the term when you add water and the green liquid or the clear liquid, whether you have a vert or a blanche, starts to cloud. And with the pastis, where most people have been perhaps familiar with the pastis, uses star anise. It has a lot of anethol in it, so very quickly turns cloudy, but it also is very sweet, not only because of the star anise, but also because pastis has sugar in it, whereas absinthe or a traditional absinthe would not have any sugar whatsoever in it. So you're starting off with a high-proof alcohol, which currently on the market is ranging from about 53% to maybe as much as 72% alcohol. The Vieux Pontarlier, for example, is 65%, so that's 130 proof. So if you contrast it to, say, Bacardi 151, you know, you're getting into a pretty high-proof alcohol. So you definitely do want to add water to that to dilute it, so you proof it down. And it also, you'll create that louche, and you'll bring out those essential oils, and the flavors and the aromas will start to blossom and really present themselves.
Now, what about the active ingredient that we hear so much about, the chujon from wormwood?
Well, thujone.
I keep mispronouncing things.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I think it's interesting for people to know that where absinthe gets its name is that wormwood, the Latin name is Artemisia absinthium, which is where absinthe gets the name. The thujone is just one component in the wormwood that that is part of the makeup of its essential oils. I've had I've been fortunate enough to have vintage absinthe that was made and in a bottle before the ban. So, the first
you have that?
I had it in France in Paris. A good friend of mine, he had a bottle of 1910 CF Berger, and that was my first absinthe. So I guess I was a little spoiled from the get go. The thing about wormwood is it is a botanical, and depending on where the wormwood is grown and the environmental conditions, you naturally will have some wormwood with high thujone levels and also naturally thujone that has naturally low levels in it. What we try to focus on is high aromas in the wormwood that we use and focus less on the thujone. The thujone itself it occurs in such small quantities that I think in and of itself you would have a hard time really isolating an effect from it. But in harmony, in combination with the other essential oils, like the oil from aniseed can act very much as a stimulant. And when you combine what comes from the fennel and the aniseed and the thujone and other components from the wormwood and the hyssop and the melissa and the coriander and all these other herbs, you start to get an effect on the body from the alcohol. And there, it's quite common for people to feel this this kind of stimulated awareness that's maybe not typical of other alcohols. And I think the common aspect of that is the herbal nature of the drink itself. And that's not as common to people, so I think they feel something they don't normally feel with other alcohols. And when I was going to school, I was a bartender, and one of the things that I noticed is I had some friends that would come in, and I could serve them a vodka drink, and they would just have not really a noticeable effect other than just the alcohol. I could serve them a rum drink and the same type of thing, no noticeable effect. But then I serve them tequila, and it's like a switch just went off, and they're a totally different person.
Interesting. Yeah, tequila does have that aspect.
Yeah, yeah. So I think with absinthe, there are similar properties where sometimes people react highly or highly sensitive to perhaps the essential oils than other people are. So I think you may have some people that feel some kind of sensation and other people that don't.
Now, I find a couple of additional sensations in addition to just the effect of alcohol. Mm-hmm. I do notice a sort of a visual sensory change with a slight, what I would call a slight elongation of time, if I want to pay attention to it. I also notice a heightened tactile awareness that is almost like having velvet right under your skin, like your skin suddenly turns to velvet. And at least that's the analogy that I use, fan of velvet that I am. And I find both of those qualities quite appealing.
Yes, frankly. Yeah, no, definitely.
So should I take a sip of this first one before we add water?
Yeah, sure. So the first one is the Lucid. And one of the things you would also note is the color of the absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
The Lucid is, let me just double check it here, 62%.
It's a very pale gold, hints of green, but more golden.
Yes, yes.
Picks up the light really nicely. And it spreads in that first sip, and I probably took, an eighth of a dropper full. It just spreads over your palate in this really pretty bouquet with, I guess you would say, with anise at its base, but lots of almost floral notes along with it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think this product, from what I'm to understand, was essentially developed with the American palate in mind, where the American palate isn't as familiar with anise-based drinks in terms of like pastis or sambuca.
Ouzo.
Ouzo, exactly. Arak, raki. So there's a number of drinks that have kind of the anise fennel base to it that's very traditional to kind of the Mediterranean region. But our philosophy is we feel that the American palate is willing to open up to a quality product and quality alcohol. So we really tried to make sure that ours was as classic and traditional as we could possibly make it. And this month's little write-up in Esquire magazine talked about two of the products that we're bringing in, the Vieux Pontalier and the Mansynthe. And on the Vieux Pontalier, they regard it as their top pick. And they described it as an absolutely classic French absinthe, as good as it gets. So
I can't wait until we get to that one.
Yes,
now, I just took a little sip of the St. George.
Yes.
Quite different than the Lucid.
Very much so. Very much so.
Immediate sensation of heat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it's followed by a cooling that would... I don't really taste any mint flavor, but there's a cooling sensation that reminds me of biting down on a mint leaf.
Yeah, no, the folks at St. George, I really like those folks. They do a really good job. I know the distillers over there had access to a lot of really top absinthe, and I really respect them for developing a product that is essentially marching to their own drum. And it's not as I would call strictly a classic absinthe, and I think even they would readily admit that's not what it is, and that's not what they were after. They were looking for something that is kind of a fusion between a classic absinthe and something of a modern twist to it, and I think they've done a very interesting job of bringing some really nice herbals to it. As far as no one knows what our secret recipes are, but they had disclosed, at least on their label, that they're bringing in a nice brandy and a star anise and a mint, the wormwood, of course, lemon balm.
Mint, you said. So the mint is there.
Yeah. Okay. And lemon balm.
Stinging nettles.
Yeah. So you wouldn't necessarily see meadow sweet or basil or stinging nettle mm-hmm. in a traditional absinthe recipe, but it's quite interesting, and I don't think that it means it can't be there. Mm-hmm. And so clearly I think they've done a very nice job.
Now this third one?
This is the Vieux Pontalier.
Oh,
this
okay.
was the product that won the double gold best class.
This is the one that's as good as it gets.
It's as good as it gets.
It's got it has a much, much softer bouquet.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I can't wait to try all of these after we add the water and see what they blossom into.
Yep.
That's really, really pretty.
Yeah.
Just very, very pretty. Very integrated.
Yes. It's really kind of an elegant, classic mm-hmm. French-style absinthe, the French vert.
How would you compare this one with that original one that you first tasted?
Well, I would say that it has the bones of that original. Okay. But the one thing that's interesting about absinthe, which is not typical of other liquors, in a scotch or a whiskey, for example, if you've aged it in a barrel for 20 or 30 years and then you stick it in a bottle and you hold on to that bottle for another 30 years, it doesn't make it a 60-year-old scotch or whiskey. It's still a 30-year-old product because the aging qualities essentially stop once it comes out of the barrel. It's not so with absinthe. What happens with absinthe is that it starts to oxidize and these essential oils start to intermingle and break down and convert.
So I need to drink all that absinthe I have stashed away?
No. You want to hold on to it.
Oh, okay.
You
want
to dole it out with a teaspoon.
Okay,
because
that's what I do.
It gets better.
Oh, okay.
It gets better as it ages.
Excellent.
And what's interesting is that is similar to Benedictine, Chartreuse. Again, a lot of herbs going into those mm-hmm. products. And they're some of the few products that actually do age, and they also, based upon their historical formulations, are almost this throwback to the Belle Epoque. Absinthe, if done correctly, could take you back to exactly what they were drinking mm-hmm. back in the 1890s.
Wasn't there that guy, I can't think of his name right now, from New Orleans?
Ted Brough, yes.
He did a call-in with Mouthful as well.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understood, they took the chemical footprint mm-hmm. of a 19th century absinthe, and that's what they're producing?
Yeah, I think that was what they were working towards. It's a difficult thing because when you take all the chemical components, all the molecules that come from these different essential oils, over time, many of them convert into other things. Mm-hmm. So even if you had a list of 10 components from coriander, for example, maybe four or five of those after 80 years wouldn't even be present. So would you be able to identify it as coriander or not? It's mm-hmm. tough to say. So I think there's a lot of supposition and perhaps even filling in of the blanks mm-hmm. Because it is really hard to tell. Have we achieved that status or not? And the only way we'd ever know is if we compared a 100-year-old absinthe with a modern product that's been aged for 100 years. So mm-hmm. it is difficult. But one thing that that people need to put in the context of is that absinthe was wildly, wildly popular in its day. And in 1876, there was 1.3 million bottles consumed in France. By the time you hit 1900, it had risen to 28 million bottles a year. Now, I think there are a lot of bad absinthe out there, and that people, maybe they've tried absinthe once and thought it tastes like radiator fluid, or at least smelled like it.
That would be the one from Portugal.
Yeah, or possibly a lot of Czech absinthe
seem
to have
that. Yeah, I
have
a bottle of the Portugal, and oh my gosh, it's so bad.
But the point is that it was not that popular because it tasted bad. It was because it tasted good. So if you drink a bad-tasting absinthe, it is just that, a bad absinthe.
You are listening to A Mouthful on KRCB. The topic this evening, of course, absinthe, with John Troia of Tempest Fugit. We'll be right back. Get your pencil ready and get your dialing finger ready.
La fille de joie est belle au coin de la rue là-bas. Elle a une clientèle qui lui remplit son bar. Quand son boulot s'achève, elle s'en va à son tour chercher un peu de rêve dans un bar du faubourg. Son homme est un artiste, c'est un drôle de petit gars, un accordéoniste qui sait jouer la java. Elle écoute la java, mais elle ne la danse pas, elle ne regarde même pas la piste. Et ses yeux amoureux suivent le jeune herbe, et les doigts secs et longs de l'artiste. Ça lui rentre dans la peau par là-bas, par non, elle a envie de chanter ses physiques. Tout son être étendu, son souffle est suspendu, c'est une œuvre étordue de la musique.
Ah, absinthe. In drinking history, takes you back to the Belle Epoque, even just smelling it. In graduate school, I studied 19th century, and even though my focus was on English literature, mid to late 19th century, early 20th, there's so much cross-pollination with France and the French artists and the whole decadence period and Oscar Wilde. It was impossible not to come across absinthe. And that seems to be the case again here in Sonoma County. There are about 10 different bars that are serving one, two, maybe three absinthes. And out in Sebastopol at the restaurant St. Rose, Mark Maliki, who is, you know, he's doing just so many wonderful things at St. Rose. He's been, first thing I saw was a salad, a honeydew melon and prosciutto salad just drenched in absinthe. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend earlier this week. She had mussels in absinthe and cream.
Sure.
So it is starting to be much more widely available. Now, why did I tell you to get a pencil and get your dialing finger ready? Don't call yet. I'm going to be giving away a pair of tickets to a very special dinner that is taking place this Wednesday night in the town of St. Helena at the Martini House. It's going to be so much fun. It's called The Killer Tomatoes That Ate France. And if I have this right, the director of either The Attack of the Killer Tomatoes or possibly its sequel is going to be there. I think there's even going to be a screening of the movie, and there's a special tomato dinner, a whole tomato menu. So I will have a pair of tickets that's two people. If Todd Humphreys, the chef, is able to get away from the line, he's actually running the line, which is where your food is produced. If he's able to get out of there and call us, he'll be calling us. But if he doesn't, at about 7:45, I will be saying it, that I'll be giving the call to the second or third caller. So the number that you will call is 584-2020. But don't call until I tell you to. And in the meantime, check your calendar, as I only want to give this pair of tickets to somebody who's actually able to go to the event. So there you go, The Killer Tomatoes That Ate France, coming up at Martini House in St. Helena on Wednesday. But now, back to absinthe. Are you going to put some water in one of my glasses?
No, absolutely.
Okay, let's hear that. So let's see. Let's do that one. That's the one, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Oh, it's turning my favorite color,
yes,
or one of my favorite colors.
Yes.
That really. Mm.
So the idea is, now we're of course adding it reasonably quickly without benefit of the sugar cube and the spoon. And the idea is that as you add the water, it starts to proof down. It starts driving out the essential oils from the alcohol itself, and it starts to create the releasing of the green fairy, if you will. So it's starting to cloud. There's a very thin, clear layer, which is still the alcohol that's not mixed with the water. The water is heavier than the alcohol, so it's moving down to the bottom of the glass. So as you add more water, that little clear green layer kind of closes up, and now it's mixed at an average proportion of about 3 to 1. It doesn't look like it's proportioned that way because the glass gets wider as it comes up, but it's reasonably diluted. If it's a little stronger, it's always good to maybe add a little less water than you think you want on it, so you can taste it, and then you can always add a little more water and adjust it to taste. As you become kind of a seasoned absinthe drinker, people will adjust the amount of water they add, either more or less, and the amount of sugar that they add.
You really just suit your own palate.
Yeah, exactly.
And I jumped ahead here and made you give me the Vieux Pontellier because I really can't drink three absinthes
while I'm on the air,
and I so want to try this one.
Yeah.
And are you going to join me?
I certainly shall. In fact, what I wanted to do is the glass that
You have these glasses handmade. They're hand-blown.
Yeah, these are hand-blown by Simon Pierce. Some of the gourmand out there might be familiar with Simon Pierce Glassware. He has a beautiful shop on Fillmore Street, but he blows them, the factories in Vermont. And he's an Irish immigrant, and he does exceptionally beautiful glass that's just incredibly clear and high quality. And so we sent him some antique glasses, absinthe glasses, and here's an example of what we call the cordon glass. This is the antique that was sent to Simon Pierce, and right next to it, even though it's you can't see it on the radio, you can see the reproduction and the original glass. But he works in a very similar style, because the antique glasses of the time were quite thick. They were in bistros and bars and restaurants, and so they were kind of beat around, so they had to kind of stand up to the wear and tear. And many times people tend to opt towards a very thin kind of a glass, but that's not historically correct for an absinthe glass. So mm-hmm. we were really pleased that Simon Pierce took up the challenge, and he has executed fantastic.
They're beautiful. Tell us about this.
So there was a glass that was out, a very rare glass, that was a single bubble that was around 1850. And we have those produced, but I also felt that if one bubble was good, then two bubbles would be better. And the thing that distinguishes absinthe glasses in general is there's always some kind of dose demarcation. In the case of the cordon glass, there's a cord or a ring of glass, and that's the dose or the shot of absinthe. In the classic Pontellier glass that you're drinking out of, there's this bulb, this reservoir at the bottom, and that would be your dose of absinthe.
So you just fill up.
Yeah, exactly. It was very helpful for bartenders to be able to dose the absinthe glass properly with a shot, if you will, of absinthe. So the double bubble is essentially taking the single dose of a single bubble and breaking it into two separate bubbles of smaller dimensions. The interesting thing about the bubble glass in particular is that with the water being heavier than the absinthe, it the water moves its way towards the bottom, and it forces the alcohol up to the top, but at the same time it's starting to mix with the water, so it creates a louche. And so I'm just going to pour in a good dose of water, and you'll be able to see what it does yourself. And for those that can't see it, if you head over to Dan, I'm sure he'll be happy to give you a demonstration.
Okay, so you pour the water in, and now you can watch it. Oh, my gosh. It's trickling down into the bottom bubble. You could just spend the night watching this.
Yes.
It is so beautiful.
It's not a... It's kind of an ugly duckling to a certain extent without absinthe in it, without it's doing its trick. It's an interesting glass, but a lot of times people don't. They just think it's a design element. It's actually form and function, because when you have these very small openings, it forces the absinthe and the water to kind of cross paths with each other, and then that louche kind of filters down. And it just kind of starts to roll around in those globes.
I've never seen anything like that.
Yes.
That is really captivating and beautiful.
It's a fun glass.
Wow. What are these glasses? How much do they sell for?
About $68 a piece. Yeah. They're hand-blown, and they're exceptional quality, and that's pretty average for his glassware.
Well, if any of my relatives are listening, I want one for my birthday, okay? And then... let's talk a little bit. God, I want to talk about the collection too, real quickly, because you also have sterling silver. Have a sip,
oh,
please.
Yes,
don't
yes,
want to make
sir.
You talk so much. You can't have a sip. Well, I'll have a sip too.
It's very tasty.
It's absolutely delicious. There's a whole tradition of absinthe spoons. In fact, you have a book. There's the book about the absinthe posters. There's also a book about absinthe spoons. There are collectors.
Yeah, the. Marie-Claude Delahaye, who has the Absinthe Museum mm-hmm. outside of Paris, has written a number of books. She's one of the foremost authorities on absinthe collectibles. And it so happens that in the poster collection of Dan's, to which we are privileged to be the custodians of it, there are a number of his posters that are actually pictured in the book as a point of reference. To the point that, some of them are the only ones known to exist.
Now, these are Dan's collection?
Yes, that's
right.
Correct.
Yeah, he has a number. He's, got three that are the only ones known to exist?
Yeah, like the absinthe champagne, for example. Mm-hmm. No one has ever seen another absinthe champagne
Amazing.
Poster. Yeah.
And then the one that is apparently popular, I thought I was the only one who preferred this one, but the absinthe bourgeoise with the cat.
With the cat,
that's correct. A black cat, no less, lapping up the papers there. And that was... I just figured it was an artist with a great imagination. He was actually from a series of photographs of this cat.
Yeah,
that lacked
yeah.
absinthe.
Yeah, it was a series of postcards that were done. Whether it was set up or I'm sure it was kind of a setup, but essentially it became this very popular postcard. And here's the Absinthe Bourgeois, which again of the distilleries in Pontarlier, which is where the Vieux Pontarlier is made. There was essentially, up to 25 different distilleries up till 1906. And part of the magic of Pontarlier is the terroir. And the wormwood that we use is Pontarlier wormwood. And the seeds from that wormwood were actually harvested from genetic grandchildren from the abandoned wormwood fields around the edges of Pontarlier that produced grew the absinthe for some of the most famous absinthe brands during the Belle Epoque. So seeds were gathered from those, and it's now being grown for us for use in our absinthe, and it really highlights those qualities.
So you're actually going to be producing an absinthe as well as importing?
I say producing in terms of the Vieux Pontarlier because I guess I've had my hands in the still
okay.
a little bit. So it was one of those things where, you know, I wanted to bring in a classic French absinthe, and there was a lot of back and forth in terms of if we felt it was ready to be presented to the public at large. But what you'll find in the antique posters is that a lot of the famous brands were actually based in Pontarlier, France. And there's actually a festival called the Absinthiades. It's a kind of a small regional festival. It's not a really big thing, but they do go back to the roots in absinthe history. There's only two distilleries now left in Pontarlier, left over from the Belle Epoque. So from what was once 25 distilleries in kind of this smaller provincial town, there's now only two. But when they were there, they were big. And so that's why you'll see Pontarlier very common, very typically on some of the classic posters.
You're going to be taking possession of these 30 posters. Are they going to be on view at your offices in Marin County?
Well, what we'd like to do is actually share it as much with the public as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to contact the folks at the Legion of Honor, so if anyone out there knows any of the people at the Legion of Honor, I think it'd be a perfect place to actually have an exhibit of these posters in addition to perhaps some of the antique glassware, but I would like to see if it's possible if we can get it on exhibit, since it's a timely topic.
Mm-hmm.
It's a topic of interest.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, and so I think some of the better local museums or regional museums may have an interest in doing a short exhibit,
mm-hmm.
because I think that the viewing public would really enjoy.
Yeah. They're absolutely extraordinary posters.
Yeah,
and you know, I think when you're looking at them, it's easy to forget. These were just throwaways. This is what came off the press every few weeks to advertise absinthe. They'd roll them up on the brick. They'd tear them down a few weeks later.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're very thin paper.
Yeah.
And even if you took really good care of them, it's very difficult to keep them in really good condition. And but there was also at this time this big collecting fervor. People, it was very chic, and a lot of people collected posters of the period. And the Maître Lafiche, there was actually this kind of poster of the month club where you would actually get a couple of these small versions of some of these very popular posters. So
makes you wish you had some French ancestors,
yeah.
doesn't
yeah.
it? We're going to take a quick musical break. We'll be right back here on Mouthful. We'll be right back. I don't think the studio here at KRCB has ever smelled better, with the possible exception of some incredible antique roses that Dragonfly Farms brought in. But this absinthe, it's just so beautiful. Now, changing the subject very quickly to tomatoes, have you checked your calendar? Looks like Todd Humphreys had too much business tonight to call in, but we'll get Todd on, we'll get him on live sometime. He does some really fun stuff over at Martini House. You know, sort of kick up your heels fun, not too serious. So if you are free to go to the tomato dinner on Wednesday night and have a penchant for things like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, a fun movie if ever there was one, give us a call now. We're going to take the third caller. 584-2020 is the number. 584-2020 is the number. If you and a friend would like to go have a marvelous Killer Tomatoes That Ate France dinner in St. Helena. And I'll see you there because I'm going to be there as well. And you just go ahead and call. You won't be on the air, so don't worry about that. And Kainoa will take your name. And if you're the first caller, if you dial right, you might be able to call back and be the third caller as well. Got just a few minutes here left. We could do a whole show just on the absinthe spoons. But in the few minutes that we have, let's give people all of the contact information so that, number one, they can find you, they can find your products. Do you have a website? I know you have a website, but is the sort of website where people can make purchases?
No. We are the exclusive importer for the products that we're bringing in. And we, in the food chain, we sell to distributors, and then distributors sell to liquor stores, bars, and restaurants. Our products have been recently approved, so they are actually getting ready to be put on a boat over here. So they'll take about a four-week boat ride. And then when they come here, we'll be distributing them to distributors around the country. It's going to be in primarily key regions like, you know, the Bay Area, California, New York, New Jersey, Florida, etc., because it's going to be heavily allocated. But I would say by probably October timeframe, you would probably find it showing up in some of your local liquor stores.
So you're talking about the absinthe itself.
The absinthe itself.
Now, the glassware and the spoons, we already know that you can get them at the Wine Exchange.
Yes, that's
over
correct.
In Sonoma. Mm-hmm. Anywhere else in this area? Do you have a list of retail places on your website?
We don't have a lot of brick and mortar retail locations that carry them specifically because they are so expensive, and are kind of your upper end specialty items. But I do know that Simon Pierce at simonpierce.com does sell a couple of the styles, the Pontalier glass that you're drinking in, the double bubble. You can actually order online. And we do have sterling silver spoons made by Lunt Silversmiths in Massachusetts that are original designs in one reproduction. And let's see, absintheonline.com actually does carry our glassware and our spoons.
I should say congratulations to Eric Metz and the lucky person who gets to go to the Killer Tomatoes at 8 France dinner. And remember, Eric, most people, if you're in the restaurant business, you already know this, but if you don't, it's easy to forget. Always leave a gratuity that would be the amount that you would leave were you to pay full price for the dinner. So having worked in the restaurant industry for a long time myself, that's always a good thing to remember. When you get a freebie, you still need to tip. So there you go. When are you going to take the post? When do you take possession of the posters?
It's arranging for the right space for them. Okay. And so we want to make sure that they are cared for safely. And but we would, again, rather see if we can offer them to a wider audience than just, you know, kind of a small location with a minimum amount of traffic. So that's what we'll be looking to do. Mm-hmm. And
as a last thing, this print here, something you printed out. Let me take a look at this. This is your company, Tempus Fugit Spirits.
That's correct.
Premium absinthe. beautiful green dress on a redhead. We like that. And she's got in her arms a bundle of absinthe, artemisia, absinthia, which I grow throughout my yard as well. And she's drinking absinthe. What will this be used for?
This is just going to be a promotional piece for our company. And we will have posters for our brands and also for the company itself. And at some point, we'll probably have this on the website at tempestfugitspirits.com. And we'll probably make this available for people if they want to purchase it. We want to have it printed up in a really nice frame-worthy paper.
It's really, really gorgeous. I got to tell you, I want that dress. And on that note, we are out of time because we've got a book review for you. And coming up at 8 o'clock, of course, it is Outbeat Salon. So thanks for tuning in. Hope you had a good time. Meet me here next week when it is Paul Aronston, who is one of the chefs participating in Slow Food Nation. Have a great week. I'm Michelle Jordan. It's Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, here on KRCB.
The author of the new book, Waiter Rant, Confessions of a Cynical Waiter, is Steve Dublinica, but you won't find that name anywhere on the book's cover. The author is listed simply as The Waiter. For the last 5 years, Dublinica has been the anonymous writer of the popular blog Waiter Rant about his life working at an unnamed watering hole in New York City, coyly called The Bistro. I've spent a lot of my life in restaurants, on the eating end, not the serving end, so I'm always attracted by books offering a sneak peek at what goes on behind the scenes. Boy, did I get my money's worth with Waiter Rant, a book that Anthony Bourdain called the front-of-the-house version of Kitchen Confidential. From cockroach hunting to squirrel invasions, from abusive managers to coke-addled hostesses to well-heeled clients having sex in the bathroom, this is the down and dirtiest account of high-end restaurant life I've ever read. Yet it manages to salvage moments of grace from the waiter's life as well. Dublinica identifies four types of waiters: the artist waiter, the accidental waiter, the career waiter, and the train wreck. The artist waiter is simply working as a waiter until they hit the big time as a writer, artist, or actor. Career waiters are mostly from Europe, where being a waiter is a respected profession with apprenticeships and years of formal training. Train wrecks, drug addicts, or the mentally unstable often end up as waiters simply because it's an easy job to get because the turnover rate is so high. Dublinica considers himself an accidental waiter. A lapsed seminarian, he took a job as a waiter to keep himself afloat for a few months while he figured out what to do with the rest of his life. But those months turned into years. By the time he started writing his blog, he was an embittered late 30-something, watching the college kids he'd trained as busboys years before turn up as lawyers and stockbrokers at the restaurant where he still worked as a waiter. Like most waiter tell-alls, the book is full of customers so obnoxious, so rude, so boorish, so unreasonable, they seem to come from the mind of a Hollywood scriptwriter rather than from real life. A friend of mine who has moonlighted as a waiter for years assures me that such customers do exist, and to be fair, Dublinica says that 80% of his customers are perfectly nice people. It's the other 20% he started his blog about. Like the woman who inquired aloud in front of her friends about his preferences regarding oral sex, or the foursome who insisted on sitting at their favorite table even though it required them to step over the prone body of a stroke victim, paramedics be damned. Then, of course, there was the doctor whose life Dublinica saved by giving him the Heimlich maneuver. His reward at the end of dinner? An 8% tip. "Next time," the waiter writes, "I let him die." Revenge, as they say, is a dish best served cold, and the waiter is one writer who definitely knows how to lay it on the table. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful. Na, 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 na. Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.
Listen to me, it's time for dinner, now let's go eat.